Hey, hey.
What's up?
Welcome to another week of Case Files.
With Kat. Oh, we're just starting.
Ashley. Yeah. just going for it, you know? I didn't have anything else to say there, so.
I think if we talk really loudly for a little while, maybe the mowers will go away and you won't be able
maybe.
To hear.
You want to just go sit outside and just stare at them? Like, just sit on your... step.
What the hell, man? They're coming late now. I don't know what happened.
Just sit there and sharpen a knife.
We do true crime. Do you want to play?
Oh, man.
How's your week?
Just been busy. It's been a busy week already.
Tuesday.
I know, but it's been a busy week. Like,
it's Thursday for everybody else, but it's Tuesday.
All day yesterday, I thought it was Tuesday.
I thought it was Thursday. So, you know, for good.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just been busy, you know, living the American dream. How's it been for you?
Well, it's not been awesome, but we're making it. Just making it.
Can I just say it? When I went and listened to our last podcast, you know, because Sarah was talking about it, and I love us. I hate listening to my voice, but I love our podcast. It is the funniest thing, even though it's meant to be serious.
Well, it's funny.
I love it. I love it. We are hilarious. I don't know if anyone else feels that way, but I think we're hilarious, and I love our podcast. It's really my favorite podcast.
Well, I love you, and I love our podcast here, so that's I don't great. Care. No, people could just stop listening to us, but we would still sit here with
we'll
our
never
little...
know because we don't look at the insights anymore.
We don't care. We just make this for us and the few people that the chamber that listen. I love it, like the president of the chamber says, so I just listened to the reading man, you know, and I love.
We were actually talking about your Ruby Frankie case today.
Oh, you were? Mm-hmm. I just love that. Yeah. I love that that's like, you know, it's nice. Yeah. It's nice. I love
screw our real
gals.
Jobs. Everyone just knows this for our podcast. It's great. I think the mowers are officially done. I don't hear them.
All right.
Woo.
So you do have a long one. I know.
I do.
So I'll just shut up now.
Oh, okay. I do have a long one because this week we're doing totally crazy shit. I'm doing a cult story, and I think I've only done one other cult story. Yes, Kevin. I've only done one other cult story, I think, and that was the Heaven Gates one, which was during our first season, so people can't even listen to it anymore. But I read about this and I wanted to do it, and it's just so fucking crazy. So here we are. I kind of jump around in some parts because there is so – I mean, this cult is so documented. There's TV shows about it. There's documentaries about it. There's podcasts. There's news articles. There's YouTube. I mean, so much about it. I will try to make it as cohesive as I can.
Sure. I'll be so sad I didn't do it myself.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. I'm researching others.
So I wanted to include all the information to kind of convey exactly how insane this cult was and how horrible it was for the people. And it's often named one of the top 10 worst cults. So I am.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm just going to dive in.
All right, go.
So Angel's Landing was a cult formed in 2001 and was led by a man named Lou Castro. Now, this was not his real name. We'll get to that in a moment. But it was started in Wichita, Kansas on a 20-acre compound. He convinced his followers that he was an angel that was thousands of years old, could cure diseases, and knew when people were going to die. Mm. The compound contained several residential buildings and a swimming pool and an ATV track. There were numerous high-end vehicles on the property, despite the outward appearance of the community lacking financial resources. So upon arrival to Kansas, Daniel Perez introduced himself as Lou Castro. So for the most part of this story, I'm going to say Lou because that is how he is referred to by the followers in a lot of the stories. Okay. But his real name is Daniel Perez. I just wanted to be clear when I start talking, referring to him as Daniel later, like when I talk about his trial and stuff, that is Lou. So he managed to convince numerous people that, again, he was this angel. Technically, he claimed he was possessed by three angels. Their names were very angelic: Amber, Arthur, and Daniel. He would perform medical miracles and predict the future. He said that he could cure diseases. He also claimed that he could predict when someone would die and that he could then bring them back from the dead. Arthur was the bad angel. Daniel.
He sounds like a...
He's a real treat. You'll see. Daniel was the good angel. And Amber, well, she was the angel of death and would come out when Lou was having a vision that someone was about to die.
And this was called Angel's Landing. I'm looking Angel's it up because I have to see what he looks
because
like.
Because that was the name of the area where they were yet. Yeah. Yeah. Please look at
what he looked like. And you said it was like in Wichita?
Yeah. In Kansas.
Let me see what he looks like.
So... Again, Amber was this angel of death. She would come to Lou. She would give him visions that someone was going to die. He would then tell those people when and how they were going to die.
I remember this.
Okay. So Daniel was born, a.k.a. Lou, was born in Aransas Pass, Texas in 1959.
Oh, wow.
And he was I know. And he was just this charismatic person. And it made him very easy. It made it very, very easy for him to convince people to join this religious group where he could perform these wild miracles for them. I mean, who wouldn't want to be around someone who could cure diseases and predict the future and raise them from the dead?
Can I say something? Sure. Listen to me. I won't interrupt. I am, but I'm not going to do it anymore. Okay. I'm looking at scrolling through photos and it says ASMR true crime. Someone did an ASMR to the story.
I don't even know what the fuck that would be like. Like how, I mean, like while telling the story.
No, how do you do that?
Especially when you hear it's this
a YouTube
story,
it's a YouTube, so you can go slow and soft is how she does it. So
that's fucking creepy when you hear the rest of the story.
Yeah. So,
moving on. In an interview, Sarah McGrath, who is at the time of her interview, she was a 35-year-old who shared her experience. She was in. She's been interviewed a lot, but one of the shows that she was in was called Deadly Cults. And she said her mother, who was a real estate agent named Jennifer Hudson. So I know it's kind of important to remember names because they all come back to play, but they get said so much that I think that you will you'll remember. So Sarah is the daughter of Jennifer Hudson, who is a real estate agent. And she mostly sold homes that her husband would build and then she would turn around and sell them. So she actually helped Daniel find and purchase the land where the compound would eventually be located. Sarah said that Jennifer was one of the first members of this cult. Within weeks after their first meeting, Sarah and her sister Emily and her mother Jennifer moved to Angel's Landing and became part of what Daniel referred to as his family. So literally within weeks, packs her kids up, moves here. So at the time, Sarah was 17 and Emily was 10. Emily was described as one of the top students of her class, school. She was one of the top students at her school. The teachers loved her. She was a very good student, really well behaved. They thought that she was going to go like super far. The girls would later recall being really young and living at home and how their mother would come home and cook dinners and their father would get home from building houses and they would have these dinners together. They said life was really great. This all started to fall apart when Jennifer got involved with Daniel, who again was going by the name Lou. So Lou described his friends as living together in harmony, helping one another, being free spirits, and living their own little version of paradise in this family. Jennifer became really interested in this lifestyle. She was completely and absolutely captivated by Lou and him talking about his lifestyle and his wealth because he claimed like he had all of this money and all of these things because he was a cattle rancher and he had invested in stocks and all of this crap. And he told her that he could control the weather and that he was a seer and could see into the future. And he was a relative of Geronimo, which I don't even fucking know what that had to do with anything. But like she made a point to say that, yeah, he told me he was a relative of Geronimo. He could control the weather. He could see into the future. So while to most people, if you heard someone telling you these things,
you would have the face that I have currently right now.
You would assume they were batshit bonkers.
Yes.
But Lou was a smooth talker. As most cult leaders, he just had this way about him that was very charming. He was very calm and described as very soft-spoken. And Jennifer was a spiritual person, and she was just fascinated with angels. So everything that Lou was saying to her was just like drawing her in.
She was speaking her language.
Yes. And it didn't help that his friends, Patricia and Brian Hughes, who lived on the commune, and they came with him to Kansas. Like, he arrived with these people, and they were looking at homes with all of them, backed up his claims to Jennifer. Patricia said she had witnessed Lou bring an animal back to life and had also witnessed him bring himself back to life from the dead. But what really hooked Jennifer at the end of the day was that Patricia said to her, and I quote, "People say you can't pick your family, but that's exactly what we've done here." So before all of this, Jennifer and her husband had a very strong relationship, but once meeting Lou, that started to unravel. They began arguing a lot, and eventually Jennifer decided to divorce her husband, and it was at this point that Jennifer moved her and her girls onto the commune, like literally just divorced her husband, packed her shit, moved within a matter of weeks. Their father was devastated, but he couldn't stop Jennifer. So originally the commune was only 10 acres, but Jennifer bought an additional 10 acres that connected to this property and built a house on it. So she contributed to it to make it 20 acres.
Wow.
Patricia, Lou's friend, went by Trish and had been friends with him for years. She was considered to be second in command. And they had met in the 90s in South Texas, where they were from, and had actually dated at one point. And even though it didn't work out, they remained friends. She was described as happy. She was known to make people laugh. She was very well liked in the cult. Brian, her husband, was a diesel mechanic who was also described as being really nice and helpful and extremely devoted to his wife and daughter.
Did they think it was a cult?
Nobody thought it was a cult.
I guess you never really don't go into anything.
They thought it was a family. They thought it was paradise. They were all free spirits. Yeah. Just living the dream.
But husband thought it was a cult once.
Jennifer's husband? Uh-huh. Yeah, Jennifer's husband recognized this as bullshit from like day one. And her kids were like, that's bullshit from day one. Jennifer did not. Jennifer thought this was like, she thought she could be a free spirit. That this was where she needed to be. That right. These were her people. Brian and Trish had a baby, and so it said that he was very devoted to his wife and their daughter. So the original person to live in Angel's Landing was a woman, or excuse me, the other original person to live here was a woman that was only referred to as KL. She was technically the girlfriend of Lou's. KL met Lou when she was 15, and he was 46.
Say that age.
She was 15. He was 46. But she claims he lied to her and said he was much younger. So they started dating and she thought she was in a consensual relationship. So that would lead me to believe he was lying and saying he was like younger than 18. But if you see his pictures.
I saw his photo. I'm just like, hold up.
No absolutely fucking way that she believed he was 17.
Man has.
But anyways, she wrinkles. Claims. Yeah. She claims that she thought
bags,
he was.
Jowls.
Sorry. No. But she claims that he lied about his age. They were in a consensual relationship. Sarah and Emily, who were Jennifer's daughters, were miserable. Sarah was very angry. She wanted to be close to her father, who had actually moved to Kansas to, like, close to this compound to be closer to his family. So he was trying to be as close to the girls as he could be. Sarah wanted her parents to get back together. She hated Lou from day one. Emily, however, was younger and more easily won over. She quickly became Lou's favorite. Lou bought the girls anything and everything they wanted or asked for. He showered them with gifts. He bought Emily like 3 horses. He 100% love bombed them.
Which one is that?
I believe that picture is Kale. Oh. I could be wrong.
I mean a baby.
Yeah. They're all babies. All the females pretty much that I'm talking about are babies. So he love bombed them. So Sarah said in an interview that she did not ever feel comfortable around Lou. However, her mother was just so enthralled with this self-proclaimed angel and believed he had their best interest in mind. Sarah would eventually grow to trust Lou and let her guard down. She said she could see how happy he made her mom, and her mom did have a job outside of the commune, and it just seemed to be working. So her mom was a real estate agent, so she was gone a lot. And Trisha would actually step in, like Patricia would step in and act as a second mom. So Emily and Sarah began to grow super close to her. They would all eat dinners together. Sarah and Emily would watch Trisha and Brian's daughter, play games together. It would seem as if they were all just one big happy family. It wouldn't be long, though, before this just became fucking horrendous. There's a lot of trigger warnings for this story. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, just think about all the trigger warnings that there could be. And if you think you might be upset, I fully understand if you don't want to listen to the rest of this.
Think of all the possible trigger warnings there are and apply them here. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay.
So Emily began. Now, Emily was the 10-year-old. She began getting sexually abused by Lou when she was only 10. After love bombing Emily and getting her trust, he began to reveal very disturbing things to her. Like I mentioned earlier, he told her that he was a century-old angel, but because he was centuries old, he had to have sex with young girls to survive, that young girls were special and that they gave him power he needed to stay alive. He said if she loved him and wanted him to stay alive, that this is what she needed to do for him. He would read her scriptures, and he manipulated her to believe that if she didn't do this for him, if she didn't have sex with him, the man she had grown to care for and love would die, and it would be all her fault. Emily would start sharing a bed with him every night, and this would go on for years. She would later say that she didn't view it as abuse at the time. She thought it was just something that she needed to do to help out because she truly believed that he was this angel that had to have sex with young girls or he would die, and that she didn't want to be responsible for him dying and making everyone else lose this man that they all loved.
Poor baby.
Sarah said that Lou had also began sexually abusing her within weeks of their arrival at the compound.
Wow.
Although he claimed he was simply trying to, quote, fix her.
Oh my God.
Because she was broken. And if she ever wanted to get married and have children of her own, she needed to have sex with him to fix her. Because remember, he can cure people. So he would threaten her that if she told anyone what was happening, something bad would happen to her father. So she did not tell a single person because she was a daddy's girl. She wanted to be with her father, and she truly felt this man would do something. So she said in an interview, there was nothing I could do, she said. I remember saying after every time, am I fixed now? He was also abusing Kale, which is kind of obvious because she was 15 and he lied to her. He would occasionally make the girls do things together. One time he had been drinking and he was really angry with the girls. So he woke them all up at 2 a.m., gathered them together in his room. He put his hands around Emily and Sarah's throats and threatened to kill them. Then he forced all three girls into the bedroom and assault them. He would refer to this whenever he would assault them. He would refer to it as, God, this is so fucking cringy. He would refer to it as feeding. as in it was time for him to feed to recharge his whatever the fuck he needed to be this angel. Sarah would say that Lou would get really mad at her if she didn't do something exactly the way he wanted it done. He would scream at her, he would become violent, and he would try to make Sarah and Emily jealous of one another. Like, he would try to pit the sisters against each other. And this was all hidden behind closed doors. In later interviews, they would ask Sarah, how much did the other members know? As in, did they know that children were being abused? To which they, which the girls and other members said they did not. Emily would say that her and Lou appeared to be so close that it wouldn't raise red flags if they disappeared for an hour or two. So then they asked,
why wouldn't that not raise red flags?
Because she looked like they were super close because they, she felt like he was a father figure, right? So like,
yeah, I mean,
but they said, okay, but what about her own mother? Why didn't this raise red flags with Jennifer? Why was she totally fucking cool with her 10-year-old daughter sleeping in the bed of this grown ass man every night? Oh my God. I never found an answer to how her mother justified it.
Maybe she was being threatened.
I think she just truly believed that he was this angel
that
needed this. Yeah.
She didn't question any of it. Nothing. I mean, when she left.
Never once. Jennifer never left.
But I mean, when she left her husband, that life, she was just like, no, everything he's saying is 100% true. And absolutely. Therefore,
these are my people. So basically, it came down to control. No one wanted to question anything Lou did. It would also later come out that many feel like Lou targeted Jennifer when he found out she had two young girls and seduced her to move on to the compound so he would have unlimited access to her daughters. So basically, he knew what he was doing from the moment he met her and found out she had kids. So this is something that Sarah said. My mom had a journal, and she had written what she felt she needed to protect Lou. She had written how she felt she needed to protect Lou. She reflected in, she was like, this is part of her Oxygen Deadly Cult interview. She said, I guess he appeared innocent or as someone who cared too much. My mother was very thoughtful when it came to people, so she felt like she somehow needed to protect Lou. He was very charismatic and quite the talker. He somehow appeared wise. In the beginning, it was like a huge support system and everyone was really close. In the beginning, things were all fine and dandy, but it didn't take long for things to turn. But my question is, why didn't she fucking feel like she should have protected her children? Like, when I read that, I was like, is she, like, I don't understand. I don't have children, but I can't imagine being a mother and being like, oh, it's totally cool if this man rapes both of my children every fucking night.
Yeah.
Anyway, she said, I was 10 when my childhood was, or this is someone else. I believe it was Emily, but they didn't specify it was Emily.
Was a minor.
It said, I was 10 when my childhood was over, one witness said during his trial, during Daniel's / Lou's later sentencing. She said, while other 10-year-olds were riding bikes or playing with dolls, I was lying naked in a bed with a pillow over my head just waiting for it to be over. While other 13-year-olds were getting boyfriends and holding hands, I was holding on to my secret and losing the people I loved one by one. When other 16-year-olds were experiencing the freedom of learning how to drive and planning parties with their friends, I was planning my own death every day when I drove to school. But if you thought raping young females was terrible, that is literally only a fraction of the horrors that took place at Angel's Landing. In February 2001, a few months before Lou met Jennifer and her children, there was a plane crash that killed one of the very, very first cult members, her boyfriend, and her 12-year-old daughter. A woman named Mona Griffith had become really good friends with Trish in the mid-90s when they were living in Corpus Christi, Texas. Mona at the time was a single mom of two young children. She had just gone through a really difficult divorce and she was financially struggling, so Trish and Lou took them in. They all began living together in this apartment in Corpus Christi. But in 1998, Trish and Lou decided they wanted to move to Rapid City, South Dakota. So Mona's son, who was named Cody, wanted to go. Was named Cody, and he didn't want to go with them, even though Mona wanted to go. So he moved in with her ex-husband, but Mona and her daughter, Lindsay, moved to Rapid City, and they lived in a house with Lou and Trish. So in later court documents, it is believed that Lou was abusing Lindsay. Mona eventually started dating this real estate man named Jim, and in February of that year, Mona, Jim, and Lindsay boarded a small private plane that would be piloted by Jim. They were going to be on their way to Nebraska. It was just supposed to be like a short trip. And Jim was a very experienced pilot. What should have been a very, very easy flight for him. However, they never made it to Nebraska. And it seemed like they had just vanished. Like people couldn't find the plane. When Mona's family heard about this, they gathered in South Dakota to, you know, help search for her. Her family says that Lou was really present and seemed to really care about finding Mona and Lindsay. However, Mona's sister started to notice that when Lindsay's young school friends would show up, they would all flock to Lou, and he really loved this attention of the young girls, and she said that made her super uncomfortable because, like, why were these young girls, like, so comfortable with him? So Mona's family was kind of like, maybe something's not right there. 6 weeks after the disappearance of the plane, the wreckage would be found. There were no survivors. Lou and Trish would end up making all of the decisions of where and when Mona and Lindsay would be buried, and even wrote the obituary where Lou listed himself as one of Mona's brothers, which extremely upset the family because they didn't know this man. They didn't like this man. And here he is making all of these decisions and writing the obituary. And he had also made a weird comment to Cody.
And how long had he known them? You said he was one of the first members, but like, is that like a decade, 5 years?
I think they met in 1998, and then this happened in 2001.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. I will get to how they were able to make these decisions. But anyways, Lou had made a really weird comment to Cody, who was Mona's son, mm-hmm. right after the wreckage was found, that he said to him, Lindsay was not supposed to die. And if she hadn't been on that plane, which according to him, she wasn't supposed to be, which leads me to believe he's not a very good angel of death if he didn't know that she was going to be on this plane.
But bring her back to life.
Yeah, that's what I fucking thought. Like, he could raise people from the dead. Anyways, he told Cody she was not supposed to die. And had she not died, he would have taken her in as his own daughter. So obviously this confused Cody about this comment, and he never understood what it meant. He never got answers of what it was supposed to mean.
We all know what it means. Yeah. I mean,
after the funeral, Lou and Trish received a large amount of money. Turns out shortly before she died, Mona took out a life insurance policy on herself in the amount of $750,000. She had listed her daughter Lindsay the beneficiary, but listed Trish as Lindsay's beneficiary in the event that Mona died. So Trish received the money because both Mona and Lindsay had died. So did she really not supposed to get on that plane? Was she really not supposed to? Anyways, Trish then gave that money to Lou. Lou had also told Trish to take out a life insurance policy on herself and name her husband Brian as the beneficiary and KL as the co-beneficiary. It was later revealed that Lou made all of the adults in the cult take out life insurance policies on themselves. He would tell them who to make the beneficiary, who the co-beneficiary would be, how much the policy should be worth, and his name was on none of it, on nothing. He wanted no links to himself. So that was 2001. In 2003, 2 years later, 26-year-old BFF Patricia drowned at the compound. Investigations initially believed she drowned while trying to rescue her 2-year-old daughter from the swimming pool. After her death, Lou came into quite a bit of money, as we will talk a little bit more later. He then went to the city.
Was he the beneficiary or was
her husband? Was,
oh, that's Brad.
But her husband then lived on the compound. And KL, Lou's girlfriend thing, was the co-beneficiary.
The co-beneficiary.
But Brian was still alive at this point, so Brian had the money.
Oh, Brian. And then so he, I mean, all the money stays on the compound and stays for everybody. So they're just living
well, Brian technically at this point has the money.
Yeah.
So after her death, Lou came into quite a bit of money. He then went to the city council and donated a new police vehicle with the only request that the vehicle have a sticker on the back for his dear friend that read, "In memory of Patricia Hughes." After this, the police became real chummy, and some of them even started attending the parties at the compound. Shock. In 2004, Lou met a woman named Megan Hubert, and they started dating. She very quickly moved into Angel's Landing, and shortly after moving in, she was instructed to take a life insurance policy out on herself. Turns out...
To me, if someone asked me to take a life insurance policy out on myself, I would... I mean, that would make me really uncomfortable.
Well, he was just trying to make sure that their children were taken care of and that they were prepared, and he was just concerned about them. He just wanted to take care of them.
Oh, my God.
After all, he could predict the future. Anyways, shortly after moving in, she was... again, told to take this life insurance policy out on herself. Turns out she was pregnant with Lou's baby. And at this point, Emily would no longer sleep in his bed every night, but the abuse would continue, as well as the abuse of every other young woman that lived in the compound. Mm-hmm. In 2006, Patricia's husband, Brian Hughes, was killed when a car jack fell and was crushed. He left the care of his daughter to Jennifer Hudson, Sarah and Emily's mother, who died in a traffic accident 2 years later. Are you noticing a fucking pattern here? Well, I will tell you why. In 2003, there was a narcotics detective named Ron Goodwin, and he was like, "What in the fuck is happening at this compound?" Like, he didn't call it a cult.
Finally.
He was, so he's.
Well, if you call someplace a compound, it's a cult. I don't know. Like, we're on the compound. I don't know. That's, well,
could they call a commune or something where they, you know, they again, all live together.
I don't know. How many of those are around right now? I don't know.
He started looking into Lou based on an anonymous tip. Never found out where the anonymous tip came from.
Oh, still?
At that, yeah. No, I mean, just someone's nudged him to start looking at Lou because of all this stuff. And he was like, Lou would throw these extravagant parties where members would invite their friends and there was tons of alcohol and the children were in the cult were very spoiled. They had whatever they wanted. Anytime anybody wanted anything, they would just go to Lou and he would just fucking buy it. It didn't matter what it was. Money was of no object. And some of them had multiple horses. They all lived in these houses on the compound. He had very high-end cars. The cars all had custom license plates like Angel 1, Angel 2, Angel 3. And the members of the cult could just drive these whenever they needed to or wanted to. Lou would basically go to car dealerships and just pick out cars like it was just chump change. And so Ron was again like, where is this dude's money coming from? He was like, how... This place looks like they don't really work. Most of them don't really work.
They don't work, but and they Lou live on a compound with really nice houses like, on it.
Huge houses.
Yeah.
Huge pool parties. Just crazy stuff everywhere. And so when Ron typed Lou's name into Google, because he only knew him as Lou at this point, he came across the obituary for Mona and Lindsay, where Lou listed himself as Mona's brother, tying him to another accidental death. So it just didn't make sense to him where this money was coming from, how all of these people were dying. But Ron, being in narcotics, really thought that this would be a drug case.
And they truly looked like accidents?
Yes, and I'm going to talk more in depth about each one. and how they looked so planned or so accidental.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Ron being in narcotics, he really thought this was going to be a drug case. He said, typically when people have this large amount of unaccounted money and they live this extravagant lifestyle and death and stuff like that, it's drug related. Like he's manufacturing drugs or selling drugs or whatever. Anyways, what followed was a years-long investigation, which was difficult because Ron didn't have police reports, official victims, or even know of Lou's true identity because, again, he was going by Lou Kastrup. Everyone only knew him as Lou Kastrup. The only person who knew his real name was Trish and I believe Brian, but I don't know necessarily that Brian did, but Trish definitely did, but she's the only one and she's dead at this point. He once tailed him to a restaurant and tried to collect like plates and cups and stuff to get his fingerprint. But the cult leader proved to be elusive. So Ron's next plan was he took pictures of Lou's cards and like made glossy prints of them. He took them to the compound and told Lou some cars had been reported stolen in the area, and he wanted to see if he recognized any of them in hopes that Lou would touch these glossy prints and leave fingerprints behind. However, Lou grabbed the envelope by the corners with his palms, then dumped the images on the table and used his fingernails to shift through them. It was very clear that Lou knew what Ron was doing, so at this point, Ron called for help. He called Detective Clint Snyder, who had just worked the BTK case, and he also called the FBI, but the FBI also couldn't figure out who Lou was, so the investigation and the search of his true identity just continued. In 2006...
I know how to get him. Get a younger looking cop, female cop. Well,
they
cop.
Didn't know that he was doing this, remember? Oh, they didn't know he was abusing them. They thought they were just children of the people that lived there and they were all kumbaya and a big happy family.
Well, they could have gotten somebody to be like, hey, I'm interested in your cult and, you know, did the whole,
you
that
had
whole thing.
To be,
I don't know.
Friends of, you had to be friends with someone who lived knew. There and invited. Like you
couldn't just show you up.
So in 2006, as mentioned earlier, Brian Hughes died in a quote freak accident.
Excuse me. With the crane or whatever.
Carjack. At the body shop that he worked at or he was working at. So mind you, he was a very, very experienced diesel mechanic. He was very used to large vehicles and the risk of being underneath them and was described as being always extremely careful and on top of safety. On this particular day, he didn't have cinder blocks under the tires like he normally did, and when the carjack gave out, he was crushed underneath. Brian was actually out of town visiting family when this occurred, but while he was out of town, like he was working on this vehicle while out of town visiting family. It was discovered that Lou had told a close friend while Brian was out of town, that he didn't expect that Brian would return from his trip. The same day, Brian died. Again, I guess, I don't know, maybe it was that whole angel of death thing he had going on. But yeah, he knew that Brian wasn't coming back. So prior to his death, he was really depressed about Trish's death. And Lou had began spending a lot of time with him. Way more than he ever had before. And members of the cult would later tell investigators that they overheard him telling Brian that crossing over is, you know, the ultimate goal and how it's so peaceful. And just saying all of these things, leading them to believe that Lou had actually caused Brian's death somehow. There was a lot of talk that Brian had actually called to tell his daughter goodbye just hours before he died. It is also thought that Lou had another vision from Amber, the angel of death, and he had convinced Brian that it was his time to go. Brian likely worked with Lou to plan out exactly how the death would occur, and Lou, of course, making sure he was as far away as he could be from Brian so it wouldn't be linked to him. That's why Brian was visiting family when the accident occurred. This would also give Brian one last chance to see his family before taking his own life. It's thought that Brian kicked the jack out from under the car, causing it to fall and crush him, making it look like an accident. Trish and Brian's daughter was now an orphan and living at Angel's Landing without either parent. After hearing about Brian's death, Ron Goodwin was like, again, oh, what the fuck? This is the most unlucky man to just have all of his friends dying. So he dove into every bit of personal and financial information he could find on anyone living at Angel's Landing. He was, quote, saying, he said, Lou is either very unlucky with close friends dying or he's involved in making it happen. So Ron.
I mean, how many people on average do you lose in a year?
So,
you know, like, yeah. I know as we get older, but damn.
So Ryan was very like, okay, I know that something's happening. Obviously, this man is involved. I just need to figure out how he's doing it and how he's making these accidents look so believable, because every one of them could literally be explained as an accident. Patricia's death, Brian's death, the airplane, like it all, like none, he wasn't present for any of it. So Ron found a disturbing pattern of the expensive life insurance policies being taken out on people in Lou's circle and then cashed in by other members. About every 2 to 3 years, this would happen. A death would occur. And he theorized, and correctly so, that bank account balances would get low in this crazy makeshift family, and then somehow someone would randomly die in a freak accident.
Or you could get a job.
Yep. What is that? It was around this time that Lou really started losing his shit. He was drinking more, becoming more violent. At one point, he pulled out an assault rifle and fired it at Sarah's head, but thankfully, he missed. He was telling his followers he would use his power as an angel to send them to purgatory and just leave them there in a state of limbo forever. He was just pissed off at everybody. He just was threatening his followers. He was just acting out. He was drinking all the time. Sarah would say that when Lou would get like this, he would rape her as punishment. And going on to say that he blamed it when he would do things like this, like when he would threaten the followers, when he would assault somebody, when he would attack somebody, he would blame it on the angels that he claimed possessed him. It was never his fault. And so the next day, right, when he was like sobering up and things were calming down, he would come to the followers and apologize for the things that the angels just made him do.
That's what Rock Thoreau did. The guy from Ant Hill Kids.
Yeah.
It's God working through me.
Yeah. He was like, it's the angels. I didn't mean to do it. I'm so sorry. You know, I would never do that to you guys. I love you guys. We're all family here. You know, and so the people were like, oh, you know what? He can't help it. It, you know, he's possessed, like whatever. They believed everything that came out of his mouth.
It's hard out here for an angel.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tell me about it. In September 2008, Lou approached Sarah and Emily and told them he had another vision from Amber, the angel of death. Now, when he was again, so when he was supposedly possessed by Amber, he was described as having this really cold and really blank stare. He wouldn't blink. He would have this really creepy smile. Like he would really play this part. Like he was really trying to get into this character. But he would approach Sarah and Emily, and he told them it was Jennifer's time to die. They would beg him for their mother's life, and he wouldn't budge. So he said, nope, I can't do anything about it. The angel has spoken. She has given me a vision. It's your mom's time to go. So Sarah would go to her mother's house and tell her Lou said that she was next to die But Jennifer would tell her it was okay and try to reassure her and tell her she wasn't going anywhere, like that she was going to be fine. Jennifer would die in a freak car accident not even weeks later. She was driving down a country road when she slammed into a gravel truck head-on at high speed, killing her on impact. Several witnesses to the accident all told police it looked like she had intentionally swerved into oncoming traffic, did not try to put on her brakes, and went right into the truck. It's thought that Lou convinced her, like he had convinced Trish and Brian, that he would bring her back to life after a period of time.
Oh my God.
He
was convincing people
that if they killed themselves to further the cause based on these visions, he would then at a later point in time bring them back to life to reunite them with their kids and families and whatever else. Obviously, none of them are alive now. So at this point, Lou decided he was done with Angel's Landing, like the area. And he and some of the followers moved to Columbia, Tennessee. Sarah, who at this point was 24, refused to move. She wanted nothing to do with this cult. She wanted nothing to do with Lou or like any of them. She was just done. And so she was still grieving over her mom, and she just really wanted to be close to her father. So Lou said, all right, I'm taking Emily though. And at this point, Emily was 17 and she wanted to go. She was very, very loyal to Lou. She had been groomed. She had been manipulated. She really thought that Lou cared about her and would pretty much do anything for him. Now that Sarah was not under Lou's control, though, she felt she could finally breathe. She could finally process some of the trauma that she had been through. And she started dating a man named Daniel McGrath. And she would eventually marry him. But the more that she would tell him about what happened to her while she was at Angel's Landing, she finally had someone she could talk to about it, he became very concerned and very fucking disturbed. He was like, that's not normal. That's not okay. And so he would secretly send an email to the FBI. And he would tell them about all of the stuff that she said was happening in this makeshift family. And this was in 2010. And he thought that there was financial fraud happening, that there was sexual abuse occurring, that all of this stuff was happening. And even told them that he knew that Lou was now living in a home in Tennessee. So while that was happening, Ron had also intensified his investigation because he was afraid that another the 2-year mark was coming up and someone else would die. And so, the FBI contacted Ron and they began working together. So the FBI yes. and Ron were yes. working together now. They knew where Lou was located.
Yes.
The investigation revealed that the group had been moving from like state to state previously, which made it really hard to figure out what crimes Lou had committed, where all of the crimes had been committed. And so they kind of decided to center the investigation around Lou's unexplained wealth. Where was the money coming from? How was he getting it? And so they began watching his home constantly. Every move that Lou made, they were watching, and they started to notice that a lot of money was being transferred out of Kansas banks into Tennessee banks, like the Angel's Landing bank accounts. And so they were like, that's strange. And around the same time, there was a newspaper article that had come out after all of this happened, and it said 6 of the supposed accidental deaths over 7 years led to Lou having millions of dollars. The life insurance, the life insurance payout for Trish's death alone was over $1 million. Wow. So he was transferring this money into this bank account in Tennessee. And that's kind of how they caught him. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. But that's where he made the mistake, was transferring this large sum of money. And he was going by a different alias at this point.
You can only take out $10,000 before it can be, before it has to be reported.
Well, he was also using a different alias now. So years after Trish died, the truth of the murder surfaced when Emily went back to the police, even though Lou had initially convinced her to lie for him when she was 11. And this led to a huge break in the case. So Emily told that told investigators that she was 11 years old when Lou told her that she needed to lie to the police. I'm just giving you some information and then I'll talk more about it, but I'm just trying to get through some of this. So Lou would later testify that he was not at the compound when Patricia died, and Emily blamed herself for not being able to save her. Emily told authorities that in 2011, 2001.
Yeah.
Hughes and Patricia and Lou arranged her death, like arranged Patricia's death. And the compound would receive $1.24 million from her life insurance policy. Emily told police that she and Patricia were sitting around one evening with Patricia's daughter when Lou approached them. He told Patricia he had had a vision that she would die soon. Emily started crying because she looked to Patricia as a mother figure. And Patricia was very calm. And she told her it was going to be okay, and that Lou would bring her back to life. She said, "It's okay. Lou will raise me from the dead. It will be okay." Emily did not believe that for a fucking second. So she continued to say that on the day of the planned murder, Lou, Trish, Sarah, and herself went to lunch. When they returned to the compound, Lou told Sarah to go get ready because they were going to go to a car dealership. He then went to the pool with Emily, Trish, and the baby. He told, the baby was 2 years old. He told Emily to take the little girl and wait inside this workshop that was like right next to the pool until he came to get her. Emily at this point is just bawling because she knows what's about to happen. And Trisha kissed her daughter goodbye and reassured Emily that she would return from the dead and everything would be fine. So Emily goes into the workshop. She's got the little girl, and she said minutes later, she hears this scream and a splash. Lou had hit Trish over the head, knocking her into the pool, and then held her underwater until she drowned. After a few minutes, he walked into the workshop and told Emily to stay in the shop for 20 minutes, then come out and get into the pool with the baby so they'd be wet when the police arrived, and then she was to call 911 and give police the story about how like the baby was supposedly drowning and Trish was trying to save her. And when she tried to save her, like in her rush to save her, she slipped and hit her head on the side of the pool. And that Emily was to then tell them that she could only save the baby, but she couldn't save Trish. And Emily did as she was told. She did exactly what she was told because, again, she was super loyal to Lou. Sarah did not know anything about this, and neither did anyone else in the group. So Emily and Trish and Lou were the only ones who knew about this plan. Lou told Emily afterwards that he had bent time so she wasn't actually present at the pool when Trish died to try and like alleviate some of her guilt and stuff. So anyways, Lou was arrested in April of 2010 in Nashville, Tennessee, because he was using the alias Joe Vingos. And this is what I was telling you about, where he was trying to open a new bank account and transfer money using this false name, thus committing identity fraud. That gave the FBI exactly what they needed to make an arrest. So he went pretty peacefully because he was an arrogant piece of shit. And he literally thought he was going to outsmart them. And so detectives were just like in this hurry to get him booked, get his fingerprints. And when they run his prints, nothing comes up. So they still don't know his name. They could not find his identity. They just knew that he wasn't Joe and he sure as fuck wasn't Lou. And they interviewed him for 6 hours about his identity, but he never cracked. So they literally just booked him as John Doe. And he pleaded guilty to identity fraud and was sentenced to 2 years in prison as John Doe. Now, they think that he took this deal because he thought that if he just took this deal for these two measly years in prison, they would stop investigating him, that he would be free to go. Like, he didn't realize that they knew more about what he was doing. And so the FBI and Ron and all these investigators, they used these 2 years that he was locked up.
So he's like, yeah, I'll take the deal. They don't go to court. So he's in jail now for 2 years while they investigate more.
So he's in prison and they start using these 2 years to figure out who he was and gather evidence. They reached out to Trish's family in Beeville, Texas. They knew that Trish and Lou had known each other the longest amount of time out of all of the other members. So they thought that maybe her family could, you know, like help with the investigation, kind of explain all of this. And this would actually help to fill so many of the gaps. And so they called Trish's sister and started asking questions, and she told them that Trish had once dated a man named Daniel Perez, but that he had died in the mid-90s, so the police were like, yeah, right. And on a hunch, the detectives called the authorities in Beeville and asked for any records they might have on a Daniel Perez, and as they were awaiting a response, Ron Goodwin receives this fax of Daniel's mugshot, which just happened to look exactly like Lou Castro. So, they finally had his real identity. He's still in prison at this time. They don't know. He does not know that they know who he is. While they don't find out much about his background or his family or where he came from, they did discover he was an experienced flight mechanic in the Army, which now makes that mysterious plane crash not so mysterious. They fully believed that he tampered with the engine, and they also discovered that Daniel had been charged with the sexual assault of two young women, but that those charges were thrown out because supposedly Daniel had died in the mid-90s after being beaten by a group of men. But what really happened is that he had faked his own death, and him and Trish left, and he changed his name to Lou Castro. Trish was just a teenager when they met, and he was in his late 30s. So it's believed that he manipulated Trish and groomed her. Like, that was really his first, I guess you could call her a victim, but she was also played a huge part in recruiting other people.
The longest one, anyway.
Yeah. And so, Trish was a teenager. Like I said, Trish was a teenager. It's thought that she did truly believe he had powers, regardless if she believed everything else about what had transpired. And now that he was in prison, people of the cult and those who had left but were still around started opening up to investigators about all the weird deaths that had happened. And Sarah was like the first in line. She gave them so much information. And Sarah, she told them that there was one time that Lou had forced her to videotape an 8-year-old undressing in a room, or he would kill her dad. Mm. She eventually broke down and did it, but Daniel claimed he couldn't see enough of what he wanted and forced her to do it again. The police actually found this video still on one of Lou's computers during a search of the house. So they knew that she was not making this up. The only true holdout in the group was Emily. So that story that I told you where she confessed, that was not, she had not done that at this point.
Oh, okay, okay.
All right. That was just to give you some background that none of these deaths were accidental.
Okay.
So she was still very loyal to him. But what?
And how old was she at this point?
She was 17, 18. Okay. She was super loyal. However, he fucked up. She wrote him a letter while he was in prison saying that she was doing very well. She was happy, like she was thriving, and she was looking forward to the future, like when he got out. He didn't like this. He did not like that she was happy. He was like, how dare she enjoy life without me? How could she be thriving and doing all of these things while I'm here in prison? She should be miserable without me. So he told her exactly that. He wrote her a letter and he berated her for living this life without her. He told her that she was not faithful, that she should not be doing. And so she was like, peace out. This is what led her to confess all of the stuff about Trisha's murder and that it was exactly what the FBI needed to then press charges for all of the shit he had been doing. So the day he was released from prison for identity theft, he was immediately rearrested and booked back to jail. His trial began in 2015. And I'll just tell you, if Emily hadn't
confessed, where would we be?
If Emily hadn't confessed, he never would have been rearrested because she was the only witness. So anyways, all of these women came forward and retold their stories of abuse that they had suffered at the hands of who they thought was Lou Castro. They were all underage at the time of the abuse. And one of the mothers of a girl he insulted assaulted in the 90s, the one that was dropped, testified that the state of Texas had filed charges against him when he was known as Daniel. And he had pled no contest to get a lighter sentence. However, the charges were dropped because Daniel was found dead in Mexico. Daniel took the stand during this trial. And honestly, again, he's just so fucking insane. He was very delusional. He testified that he did not fake his death in the 90s, and he had actually been on the way to the courthouse for sentencing when a random group of angry men attacked him and beat him to death when some people took him in and healed him. Even though I thought that he could heal and cure things, but he said these people did. Then he told the court that it had actually been Trish, 15-year-old Trish, who had convinced him that his name was Lou Castro. He claimed he didn't know what his real name was, that he was told his name was Lou Castro. He said he had no memory after being beat so badly. During his trial, Daniel's own defense, because he fired his lawyer at one point and defended himself.
As one does, yes, when they're sane.
He's very wise. Mm-hmm. He's an angel. Three angels. I mean, he's got this. in his own defense, he says that Sear.
Don't get him mad because Amber will look at you with those cold, right, dead eyes.
During his trial, after he took over his own defense, he said that, I'm not a seer. Seer was just a nickname that I gave myself. That he said that he never claimed to be an actual seer or that he could tell the future. He just called himself Seer. That was just his nickname. And that he had severe memory loss due to that beating in Texas and didn't know where his millions of dollars had come from. And most insultingly, he claimed that he had an injury to his penis that prevented him from having sex if the partners didn't consent, and that all of his partners were of legal age and they all gave consent.
Get the fuck out of here with
he
that mess.
He on stand
oh my said God. That his, he testified to that?
On stand, he said that his private areas would not work if his partners weren't uncorporated. Is there
a child out of the room right now? Okay.
He said that it wouldn't corporate if his partners didn't give him consent. Like, he just couldn't do it. He just
couldn't get it up.
You know, because 8-year-olds can give consent.
Get the fuck out of
he
here.
He claimed that he never abused any of these girls and that they were making all of this up and that he had never told a single person that he had any kind of powers. He claimed that the women at Angel.
But I thought he had really bad memories. So how could he possibly know that for sure if he can't remember things?
He claimed that the women at Angel's Landing handled all of the money, all of the time. So wherever they got it from, that was on them. He had no idea how they earned their money.
But what about his visions?
He claims that they made that all up. He said these women were just lying. Several other women testified.
What about the men? They all died.
Not really that many men. A lot of the members wanted to remain anonymous. They didn't come forward.
What about Jennifer's husband?
Jennifer's husband never witnessed anything because he was never on the compound.
He was never on the
compound. So he claimed that the women, again, that all the women handled all the money. He didn't know where it came from. Several other women testified that Daniel, a.k.a. Lou, coerced them into sex when they were just minors. One said the girls were told that Lou was a type of seer, and another testified that she was submitted out of fear for her life and the lives of her relatives. Others testified about millions of dollars in life insurance policies sold to people associated with him who died after naming others in the commune as beneficiaries. The witnesses said that Perez directed the scheme and profited from it. He was the only one that created the schemes. In reference to Amber, Arthur, and Daniel, the three angels who supposedly he was possessed by, he said he never told anyone that, and that those names were just names he liked to be called during sex. He said that...
Call me Amber. No, I'm Arthur tonight.
Yeah. He said that he didn't like to be called by his own name, so he liked to be called by those three specific names. And he went on to say that footage of that 8-year-old...
Jason, call me something. Call me Daniel. Call me Daniel in
Arthur.
Bed.
No.
That's so weird. Like, another gender. I mean, that's cool. But I mean, that's.
He said he just didn't like to be unbelievable. Called his own name. And so those three names were just names that he would randomly give people.
Guess what?
Consenting
Lou wasn't
adults.
His real name.
Yeah, he said those were just the names. He went on to say that footage, of that 8-year-old who was on camera.
Someone else put it there?
Well, he said it was found on Sarah's computer. So, obviously, that was her own sick desire. And he never forced her to do anything. He's never even seen that video.
A child.
He's never seen the child undress. He has no idea where that video came from. It was on Sarah's computer.
She's a child.
Daniel was charged with 28 charges. Because obviously the jury.
Was he found guilty?
Oh, yeah. The jury did not believe a fucking word.
I was like, I'm ready to flip this table.
The jury did not believe a fucking word of anything that came out of his mouth. They were like, are you being so for real right now? Like, you told these people you were an angel. You could cure people. You could raise people from the dead. You threatened them. You abused them. You convinced them to get these life insurance policies, and then they all mysteriously died, and you didn't know anything about it. You don't remember a thing because of a beating that happened in 1997, and it's like 2010 at this point, or 2015. Anyways, Daniel was charged with 28 charges. His charges included first-degree murder, 8 counts of rape, 8 other sex crimes, 8 counts of making false writing, and 3 counts of aggravated assault. He could only be charged with Trish's murder as it was the only one that had a witness. So the other deaths are still currently listed as accidents. Again, had he not written that letter back to Emily berating her, they wouldn't have been able to charge him with any of the murders and none of this probably would have happened. Because they couldn't pin anything on him until that she just opened the floodgates. So he was found guilty on all charges and was sentenced to 2 life sentences in prison plus 33.8 years on lesser charges with no possibility of parole for 80 years. And he is currently 63. He is still in jail. Parole is never going to happen. He's in jail in Kansas. And Sarah said if there's one message that she hopes people will get from her experiences is that cults can find ways to entrap people without them even realizing it. I don't think cults are common. I think they were, that my situation was very uncommon. My mom just kind of accepted all of these whimsical things that he would tell her. She was just sucked into it. I don't think it's a very common thing at all. But I also think that people who are in a cult may not realize that they're in a cult until they've been out for a while. I didn't realize I was in a cult until I had been out for many years. She did end up, as I mentioned, married to Daniel. And Emily also later in life recovered and got married. And they both have PTSD, obviously. But who wouldn't after going through shit like that? But they're both doing great. Daniel's in jail. And that is my story of the Angels Landing cult.
Damn, girl.
In the show notes, I'm going to post this link to a YouTube video of this woman who does a very deep dive into it. I mean, a lot of my information came from stuff that she was saying, but she plays news clips and, you know, she's just really good. But I also post a lot of other links if you want to read more about it. But those will all be in the notes.
All right, guys. That was a good one. That was a good one.
So...
wow.
That's the last cult story I'm ever doing.
How am I? Well, you know, I love a good cult, but how am I going to top that?
We all know you're doing a disappearance next. So
maybe.
Tipsy topsy world.
You know, who knows? Because I'm all over the place right now.
There's no shortage of crazy, insane shit that's happened in this world still happening.
Oh, I know. So the season 2 of The Jinx just dropped weekend. So we're stoked. We watched that. And it's like, gosh, I just remember like what 2013 when that came out. Like we just had Olivia. We're in our, was that 2013 or 2015?
He's back in the room.
2015, I think. And so he was like sitting on the couch just like, oh yeah, it was 2015. Shut up. Like when he says it, like I killed them all, of course. You know, so what did I do? Yeah. Oh, I killed them all, of course. And they have footage of the night that, the night it aired at the director's house with the victims' families there. And the Galveston detective, Judge Jeanine Pirro, the family of his wife that disappeared, they're all in this room. They're all just like on couches and chairs and they're all there holding each other going, like you could just hear a pin drop. And then you hear him say, well, I killed them all, of course. And just like, just to be in that room, tears just welling up. And the parents of the wife that disappeared are just like, yep.
Yeah.
That's it. You know, it's just like, wow. To be a fly in that room.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, I screamed. I hit Jason and screamed.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Wow. Oh.
Yeah. Sock screamed too.
Oh, he's such a belly rubber. Hi. Look at that belly. But anyway, yeah. So lots of good stuff on TV for sure. Go watch it. The Jinx. If you haven't seen the first season, wow. I did. I covered Robert Durst. Was that the first season? Maybe it was the second.
I don't think it was the first season.
Anyway, but yeah, that was intense. But anyway, that's it.
Yeah.
That's all I got. All right, everybody. Until next week, we hope you have a good week out there. Remember, if you need any resources, need help, just want to talk, we're here.
If you see something, say something.
If they make you like move onto a compound, maybe ask someone if they think it's a cult, and then, you know, someone you trust. If you have to give a life insurance policy over.
If you drive a fucking car that has Angel 1, Angel 2, Angel 3. Sus. I'm just saying. There were so many flags. They didn't know, I guess.
You should never be isolated from your family. That's a flag.
If someone tells you they're an angel that has sex with young children, maybe question it. Don't know.
They were babies.
I'm talking about the parents.
Oh, the parents, too. The parents did allow that. God damn it. Ugh. All right. Go take a shower. Gross. All right, everybody. We will see you next week. Bye.